Chapter 2. Winona. "What is it this time?" the woman asks wearily. The officer stifles a yawn. The woman can't blame him. It is, after all, 4300 on a Tuesday.
"Aggravated assault, but the victim dropped all charges, so you're good to go once the bail is paid."
She rubs her eyes tiredly, nods, takes out her wallet. Their footsteps echo in the darkened, empty station, and she keeps her gaze straight ahead, avoiding eye contact with the officers milling around the holding cell area. They turn the corner, and sure enough, there's a boy sprawled across the bench in holding cell A, relaxed and comfortable as anything, like he may as well be lounging in a beach chair. He's whistling something indistinguishable, his arms crossed around his head against the cell bars, one leg propped up on the bench while the other dangles off the side. The blonde head tips back as she approaches, and despite the cuts and bruises and the impressive shiner, George Kirk's bright blue eyes fix on her, and her chest constricts as always. The boy gives her a crooked, upside-down grin. "Hey, what's a lady like you doing in a place like this?" Winona Kirk sighs. "Jimmy. How did you even get into that bar, Jimmy?" she asks when they pull out of the parking lot. He shrugs, looking out the window instead of at her.
"Turns out a really good blowjob can get you almost anywhere."
The car ride is silent after that. Tom wakes up a few days after Jim and starts screaming and thrashing, and he needs three nurses to hold him down so he doesn't hurt himself. His yelling is frantic and incoherent. All Jim can pick out is the occasional name: Natalie, Baby, Sam, Jim, Kodos. Jim staggers over to Tom's bed, clutching the rail to keep himself upright, and tells him that Kodos is dead. That Kodos is nothing but a pile of burnt flesh and ashes, and he's never, ever coming back. He can never, ever hurt them again. Tom's eye flashes to Jim's, and for the first time, there is recognition. "JT," he gasps.
"Yeah, Tom," Jim says, grinning past the burning in his eyes. "It's me."
"Erica?"
Jim's throat closes up, and all he can do is shake his head. Tom lets out a low, mournful sound like an animal in pain. The nurses shoo him away then, and Jim watches while they check Tom's blood pressure and give him water from a little straw and avoid mentioning his face. When they're all done with the basic vital signs and about 8 different injections, the nurses leave, and Tom turns to Jim and says,
"I don't believe it."
"Don't believe what?"
"That Kodos is dead. I don't believe it for a second."
"He has to be."
Jim bites out. Tom looks ready to argue, but Jim turns to him with a look so ferocious that Tom shuts his mouth with a snap and doesn't bring it up again.
"Talk to me, Jimmy," she says when they get home. She doesn't bother to turn on the light.
"Aggravated assault?"
"Well, you see, I..."
"Oh."
Jim cuts himself off with a theatrical yawn. "Oh man, I'm whacked. Turns out beating up innocent bargoers really takes it out of you. Rain check on the heart-to-heart, though."
He makes his hands into guns and mock shoots them at her. She just stands there impassively, eyebrows raised, arms crossed.
"Oh, wow, that's nice. That's a great look on you. Very momish. You look like a proper mom in everything."
The barb hits deeper and harder than Jim can possibly know.
"Don't say that. Don't you dare say that. I'm here, aren't I? I'm here using every bit of leave I have so you have someone to bail you out of jail."
"And, you know, that's sweet and all," Jim sneers. "But I never asked anyone to sacrifice for me. I'm doing just fine by myself."
Winona looks at his beer and blood-stained clothes, his bruised face, his empty eyes.
"Of course you are."
He tightens his jaw, turns, and storms upstairs to his bedroom. Winona can't find it in herself to stop him.
Once the doctor declares Jim mentally capable of personal evaluation. And what does that even mean? Personal evaluation. They make it sound like they're going to help Jim come up with New Year's resolutions. They bring Jim into Dr. Milovan's office, where he spends his time sitting cross-legged on a fluffy white couch and glaring at the psychiatrist on the armchair in front of him.
You have been through an extremely traumatic time of your life, Dr. Milovan tells him calmly. But it is over now. I want to help you unload the past few months so that you can leave this experience behind you.
Jim just stares at her in mutinous silence. He can't leave Tarsus behind him. Tarsus is him now, and even if he could, Kodos would still be his first and second and third and tenth, and Sam would still be dead. She continued to ask him endless questions, but he has nothing to say. At long last, she gives up and says exasperatedly, I don't know what it is you want, Jim. After months of wanting so much, so badly, food, safety, home, comfort, escape, Sam, Jim doesn't want anything anymore. He can't imagine wanting anything ever again. If he does someday want something, though, he knows exactly how to get it. His mom, on the other hand, asks only one question. What were his last words? He looks at her. Knows she's looking for something specific. Maybe for a final I love you, like in a repeat of Dad. Or maybe for anything other than a repeat of Dad. He called Kodos a filthy, rotten bastard, says Jim. His mother's lips twitch in a smile for the first time in weeks. Dr. Milovan seems to have about as much luck with Natalie as she does with Jim. Tom, on the other hand, can't stop talking about Tarsus. Everything he says has to do with Tarsus, or reminds him of Tarsus, or Tarsus, Tarsus, Tarsus. Tarsus haunts his every thought, his every step. He tells Jim that he keeps revisiting events in graphic detail, and when Jim tells him to stop, he replies that he can't. He dreams so vividly that it may as well be happening all over again. So Tom doesn't sleep very often, which works for Jim because neither does he. Then one day, Jim's physical therapy session is interrupted by Nurse Roberts, who barges in looking frantic and breathless and says, Jim, we need you. Tom is... And Jim doesn't need to hear any more. He's in his wheelchair and Roberts is pushing him out of the room, sprinting down the hall while Jim just tries to hang on for dear life. They fly into Tom and Jim's room, where Tom is shouting and thrashing, held down by leather restraints just like he was when he first woke up. All Jim can understand of the garbled screaming is Kodos. Jim stumbles up and out of the wheelchair and goes to his friend. Tom, he whispers, putting a hand on one of his friends. Tom, hey, it's me. Talk to me. You gotta talk to me, dude. You're not making any sense. Tom's feverish eyes focus on Jim. His wrists are held fast by the restraints, but Jim can feel his fingers scrabbling at the sheets uselessly anyway. It was him, JT, Tom rasps. Who? Says Jim. Who was it? Tom opens his mouth, closes it, swallows, makes a strangled noise, clutches at the sheets. Jim turns to Nurse Roberts. Let him out of the restraints. Roberts looks back at him doubtfully. He is going to hurt himself. He's trying to tell me something. Let him out of the restraints. Roberts hesitates, but eventually complies, although he stays nearby to protect Jim from Tom, as well as to protect Tom from Tom. The 15-year-old reaches up and clutches Jim's hand like it's a lifeline. Who was it, Tom? Jim asks again, his voice a gentle and quiet opposition to the pounding in his own chest. Tom shudders, then whispers, Kodos. Jim reels back. No. No, it can't. Kodos is dead. He has to be. Someone is making a horrible keening noise, and after a few long, labored moments of focusing on breathing and not blacking out,
Jim realizes it's him. He staggers back and collapses onto his own bed, staring sightlessly ahead. If Kodos is alive, no, he can't be alive. Jim can't.
You saw Kodos? Nurse Roberts repeats, alarmed. In this facility? Where?
Slowly, Tom raises a trembling arm and points directly at Roberts. Jim stares.
I only saw him once, Tom says, but I know that face. That's him, isn't it, JT? That's Kodos.
Jim stares some more. Nurse Roberts looks like he got hit over the head with a 2x4.
No, Jim says at last, and suddenly feels unbearably tired.
No, that's not Kodos. Go to sleep, Tom. You're seeing things.
Tom does. Jim doesn't. It hits Jim at random intervals that Sam is gone. The first time is when Mom is at his bedside at the emergency refugee hospital, and she's just looking at him, pitying and a little scared. And Jim wants to turn to Sam and give him some sarcastic comment, or maybe grin, or maybe an embarrassingly weepy hug. But then Sam is dead, and Jim stops breathing. Jim stops breathing, and his heart stands still, and the room spins, and his vitals go through the roof, and Mom starts yelling, and the doctors come in to sedate him. And as Jim floats away in a current of empty, spinning black, he hears himself calling for his big brother. It happens again when he's having lunch with Natalie, Tom, and Kevin. And Kevin just says, "Spaghetti is my favorite." That's all he says. Sam didn't even like spaghetti, but out of nowhere, Jim buckles under the weight of Sam's absence all at once and has to leave the dining hall to throw up. When he comes back, Kevin looks miserable and apologizes. And Jim says he didn't even like spaghetti. No one makes fun of him. Another time is when Jim is back home and Frank remarks,
"Men are very mistreated too these days, you know. People look down on them for getting ladies pregnant and not wanting to stick around. Well, that's just the way of the world."
Which is just a perfect example of one of the many, many things about Frank that Sam and he surreptitiously make fun of together. Jim rolls his eyes and looks over to his brother. And when he isn't there, Jim is hit with this nauseous, lightheaded feeling like he's been punched in the gut. He finds himself gasping for air and curling in on himself, the chorus of "Sam, Sam, Sam" echoing like a siren, like a death toll, like he never left Tarsus at all. If Frank notices, he makes no indication. Mom notices, but never says a word.
"With kids like that," Frank tells her.
And by that, he means Jim, like he's ever dealt with kids like Jim before. Like there are any kids like Jim.
"You've got to stop enabling them. Stop bailing them out of jail. Let them hit rock bottom, otherwise they'll never turn their lives around."
Jim says his first words to Dr. Mullivan 5 minutes into his fourth therapy session, long after the psychiatrist has given Jim up as a lost cause and told him so. Jim's first words to Dr. Mullivan are as follows.
"Listen, Mel."
Dr. Mullivan's purple eyebrow twitches, but otherwise, if she is surprised, she sure doesn't show it.
"Yes, Jim." "I hear you've been terrorizing children again, Mel. You know that looks bad. What will the neighbors say?"
"Are you referring to yourself?"
Jim scoffs.
"You wish."
"I'm talking about Kevin. He told me yesterday that you've been demanding answers about the children's rebellion from him, even though he's told you over and over again that he doesn't remember what happened." Jim pauses to send the psychiatrist a dirty look.
"He was sobbing. He's not trying to mess with you. He really doesn't remember. He lost his whole family in a matter of months. Don't you think he could do without an evil psychiatrist to top it all off?"
"I am not trying to terrorize Kevin, Jim," Mel tells him. "Repression of memories is extremely unhealthy for the psyche. The mind is protecting itself from pain, but that pain must be brought to light before it can heal.
Well, I think if the mind is trying to tell you to back off, then you should leave well enough alone.
So it looks like we both have opinions. Mel studies him. Do you wish you could forget, Jim?
Nope, says Jim. It's been all giggles and fun times for me.
Jim, she sighs. Let us be serious. He leans forward.
Okay, let's. You leave Kevin alone, or else.
You are very protective of him. Do you see him as a little brother of sorts? The remark knocks the wind out of Jim, and he snarls back.
Does it matter?
Of course it matters.
Well, then you're right. Kevin and I were so close. He's almost like a great aunt to me.
The psychiatrist sighs again and shakes her head. I cannot leave Kevin alone, Jim. His testimony is needed for case evidence.
Why? Kodos is dead.
Maybe so, says Mel, and the slightly patronizing maybe grates on every nerve in Jim's body. But the Federation still wants the full story of what occurred here.
So ask Tom about the Children's Rebellion. I know you know that Tom knows everything Kevin knows, and God knows he's more than willing to talk about it. Won't shut up about it, in fact.
True, Dr. Melvin admits. But there is another part of the testimony that only one person is alive to tell us. She pauses, looks at him shrewdly. Jim, can you tell me what it was like to be one of the lucky ones?
Jim probably should have expected that.
The lucky ones.
What a joke. Out of the three, two were dead, and one lies awake at night wishing he were too.
When he speaks, his voice is careful and flat, and his stomach is clenching with the too familiar feeling of bargaining away everything he has.
If I tell you, will you promise to leave Kevin alone?
He hears her quick intake of breath, the suppressed note of excitement, satisfaction in her voice. Yes, of course. We can use Miss Eldwain or Mr. Lighton's testimony on the Children's Rebellion, if we had yours to supplement them. So Jim takes a deep breath and tells her everything. He tells her how Kodos used to teach them, mentor them, take an interest in them. He tells her how he couldn't believe that Kodos was behind the executions at first. He tells her about finding as many kids as they could and running for their lives. He tells her about stealing, about hunger, about what Kodos did to Sam, what he did to Erica and the rest of the Children's Rebellion in front of everyone on the day Sam died. The only thing he doesn't tell her is what Kodos did to him in private. Dr. Melvin takes notes. Now, don't you feel better? She asks when he finally finishes. Jim feels sick and empty and violated. He feels like how he felt after his first time with Kodos in the storage house.
Yeah, he says. Loads better.
Winona spends her nights looking up at the stars. There's something about them, something almost physically perceptible that pulls her in, calls her out into the beautiful endless beyond. Into the infinite what could be and away from the ugly, painful what is. Maybe it's how the stars look down on human emotions, human endeavors, human humanity, and it never phases them. They remain untouched by all, impassive, impregnably beautiful. A perfect contrast to the human, who is touched and molded and hurt by everything. Maybe it's the magnetic attraction of opposite poles that pulls her. Winona looks up and sees Jim sitting on the roof, staring at the same stars. And she knows that theirs was never difficulties of difference, but the magnetic repulsion of two similar poles. Jim isn't home most nights, but when he is, he wakes up screaming. Winona has never been able to sleep through the crying of her children. Not when they were only babies, and certainly not now. But it is only now that Jim's cries paralyze her. She never, not once,
goes to him. She would have no idea what to do if she did go to him.
Instead, she listens and waits and waits. She listens as her son's screams cut off and slowly taper into whimpers, then to labored breathing, then to silence. She waits for when she'll be able to go back to the stars, where she has always succeeded. She waits for when she will be able to leave this house, this role where she has always failed. And every night, Jim follows the lub-dub heartbeat of his nightmares. Screaming silence, screaming silence, screaming silence. And Winona waits. She waits and tries to tell herself that she stays away because Jim won't appreciate her interference. And not because seeing George's face pale and wide-eyed with terror might just break her. The dude Jim buys his drugs off of is A, a friend of a friend of a friend, B, a benzite appropriately named Pusher, and C, a huge wuss. I got to the handoff spot right, but then I see this guy. He's wearing this long coat and looking all suspicious. I could have sworn he was a cop, and man, I got a 3-year-old girl to take care of. I can't go to jail, so I hightailed it out of there. Pusher explains when Jim and his buddies from the club ask where the goods are. I still got your money. He gestures to the suitcase in his hands. But I could have gotten busted or killed or worse, man. I'll get them for you next week. Jim scoffs. Nah, you'll find some reason to drop the ball next week, too. You're just a chicken. The benzite splutters and tries to deny it, but Jim cuts him off with some obnoxious clucking noise, and soon enough all of his hangers-on have joined in, too. You think it's so easy, huh? I dare you to try it yourself. Pusher shoves the suitcase into Jim's chest, obviously expecting him to back up, back out. Jim tilts his head and raises an eyebrow. You're on. The fifth time Winona picks Jim up from jail. This time from a jail over 50 miles out of Riverside. How did he even get there? She forcibly sits him down on the living room couch and makes him explain. She can make him sit, and she can make him talk, but she can't make him look at her. It was just a dare, Mom, Jim mutters to the couch cushions, which, perversely, makes things easier. When she doesn't have to talk to George's face, George's eyes. You could have gotten killed, she says quietly. Jim shrugs, plays with a hole in his jeans, doesn't look the slightest bit perturbed by this possibility. Jim, look at me, Jimmy. He doesn't. His lips curl in a humorless smile. Do you really want me to? The seemingly innocent question freezes the blood in Winona's veins. What do you mean? He laughs softly, shaking his head, and finally meets her eyes. She can't stop her sharp intake of breath. You think I don't see it? She recoils from the scorn in George's expression. You think I never noticed that you can't stand to look at me anymore, he says, his voice low and oddly calm. That whenever we make eye contact, you actually flinch. I've seen pictures of Dad when he was my age. I'm not stupid. Winona can't reply, is struck speechless. Speechless, horrified, exposed. And the second stretch into silence, broken only by the muted ticking of the living room clock. So which is it? Jim asks with a wide and completely fake smile. He stretches lazily. Do you avoid looking at me because you miss him, or because you can't stand to see what I'm doing with his face? What you're... She manages. What? You can't tell the two of us apart anymore. So it bothers you. Where this mouth has been. Where this dick has been. How many people have watched the carbon copy of your husband come? He smirks. Or maybe it bothers you because you know that if I didn't have half of your DNA, you'd be the first in line for a piece of me. There are so many answers that Winona will not, should not, cannot give to that. I know about Kodos, is the one that ends up coming out of her mouth.
All at once, something shuts down in Jim's expression. He gets to his feet, scrubs a hand over his face, starts pacing the floor with the disquiet of a man twice his age. "Who told you?" he demands eventually. "Your friend Tom. Thomas Lighton."
"I'm going to kill that guy," Jim says, matter of fact.
"He was right to tell me. Don't you think it was important for me to know my child was raped?" she asks, her voice thick. Jim flinches.
"I don't know what Tom told you, but it wasn't rape. It was my idea every single time. But hey, you keep on thinking it was rape if it makes you feel better. It's a lot simpler that way."
Winona knows she's long lost any control she had over this conversation.
"Are you trying to tell me that you liked what he did to you?"
"Maybe I loved it," says Jim offhandedly.
"You don't know what you want," she says. "You're just a kid."
Jim whirls and snaps a hand out, sends the porcelain lamp to the floor in a shower of noise and blue shards.
"Stop treating me like a child," he yells, turning on her.
Winona flinches from George's fury.
"I don't know where you've been, but I haven't been a kid for a very long time. I'm not some confused little boy who fell victim to the evil executioner of Tarsus, okay? I know exactly what I want and how to get it. You just can't wrap your mind around the fact that maybe I wanted it. Maybe I wanted the chains and the whips. Maybe I wanted to be violated down to every thought in my head and every cell in my body. Maybe I wanted it so rough I couldn't walk for a week."
"What?" he taunts when she winces.
"You're saying it doesn't bother you? Go ahead, tell me I'm wrong."
Winona feels the raw, helpless horror rise like bile in her throat, rises to her feet.
"That's enough," she shouts. "I said that's enough, George."
Both Jim and Winona freeze. Jim's face twists, and for a moment she thinks he's going to cry. But instead, George's face smirks, and his eyes gleam maliciously.
"Sorry, sweetie. I forgot how difficult it must be to watch your perfect hero husband get reincarnated as a slut."
Jim stares hard at her, and then turns abruptly back to the couch. And suddenly, Winona can breathe again. She hates how obvious it is.
"That's why this is so hard for you. Seeing me all beat up or in jail or banging everything in sight. It's not about me. Not really. It's that you can't handle watching him crash and burn all over again."
His voice is challenging, expectant, waiting for her to correct him. And waiting. And the silence stretches on, and Winona doesn't correct him. Can't correct him, because they both know it's true. She always brings colorful flowers when she visits their graves. Because there's something deeply unsettling about the simple gray headstones of her vibrant, dynamic, beautiful husband and son. She can sit and talk to George's headstone for hours, and has, frequently. But today she talks to Sam, calling on the memory of the only person who's ever been able to handle Jim. "We haven't spoken since the fight," she tells him. He wakes up past noon, eats, and goes out on that motorcycle of his. Heaven knows what or who he did to get it. If he ever comes home, it's at an insane hour of the morning. Frank says that if he doesn't appreciate us, he should see how he likes it on his own. Sometimes I think he's right. Winona sighs, plays with a blade of grass. But then I see him sneaking food into his room, just in case, and I can't... She cuts herself off, rubs at her eyes. "Either way, I'm running out of leave." She sighs and tips her head towards the sleek gray sky, where her beloved stars lay disguised behind a veil of light. "It's been almost a year, Sam. I've been grounded for almost a full year, and I don't know how to help him. I can barely look at him these days." Sam, of course, makes no reply. The wind keens and plucks at her coat, as if begging her to stay. "Maybe Frank is right," she says at last. "Maybe there's just nothing I can do."
"What?"
the guy with the gravity-defying bangs says, looking Jim up and down.
Skinny little thing like you. Don't make me laugh.
Jim grins.
Hey, this skinny little thing could top anybody in this room and make him like it.
Sure, Bangs replies, chuckling.
Point to anybody. I'll prove it to you.
He thinks about it, then points across the club.
All right. I dare you to top that fine lady over there.
Jim turns. He's pointing to a 10-foot Klingon woman in the corner. She looks like she could snap Jim in half without breaking a sweat and use his bones as toothpicks.
You're crazy, Pusher tells Bangs, horrified. People don't top Klingons. It can't be done. She'll kill him if he even tries.
Jim tilts his head and raises one eyebrow. The 79th time Jim comes home smelling of blood and sex and weed, Winona fills out the form officially taking her off leave and back into the stars. Frank assures her that she's doing the right thing. She just prays to whatever's out there that Jim doesn't find out before she can find a way to tell him. Jim finds out, of course. A week later, she walks in on Jim reading a message on the house holofeed, stony-faced, and Winona immediately wishes she had told Starfleet to contact her on her private line.
So, he says, his voice calm, you're going back to space.
Jimmy, she tries, moving toward him. He takes a step back, away from her, and for a moment the facade breaks, and Winona can see the wide, betrayed eyes, the tiniest tremble of his hands on the pad.
Stop calling me that, he hisses.
She blinks. Jimmy, I've always called you that.
Well, you're the only one who does. Everyone else calls me Jim.
That's not true, she thinks. She's not the only one who calls him Jimmy. There was also... Oh, honey, she says when she realizes. She takes another step closer to him. I miss him too.
Jim takes another step back. I don't miss him.
Her throat tightens, but she forces herself on, desperate to find even the littlest remnant of the Jim she left on Tarsus. Of course you miss him. You love him. You were always so close. I remember when you were little and I would pretend to be leaving the house without you so you would hurry up, and Sam would think we were really leaving without you and start freaking out and yelling that we had to wait for you.
Jim shakes his head. Shuts his eyes like the story causes him physical pain.
I don't love him. I hate him.
He died for you, Jimmy.
Jim.
She can barely speak past the lump in her throat.
Well, I didn't ask him to, he screams.
He throws the pad across the room and Winona takes a step back. For the first time, fearing for her own safety.
I told him not to. I begged him not to. I could have taken what Kodos gave me. I was fine.
He pauses for breath, his chest heaving, his eyes suspiciously bright.
You think I want this? He says wretchedly, not looking at her. You can't stand that I'm here when they're not. You can't even look at me because you blame me for their deaths. Everyone sees me and says, too bad about that Kirk boy. His father and brother were really something. And I...
His voice catches.
I never asked him to sacrifice anything for me. My whole life, everyone's been telling me that Dad loved me enough to die for me. But if you ask me, I would have preferred if he had loved me enough to stick around. And now Sam... Sam, he...
Jim's voice goes high and strangled, and he presses the heels of his hands into his eyes like he can forcibly keep the tears back.
And now you want me to be grateful for Sam dying, too. When all he did was die. Just like Dad did. He went up against Kodos even though I told him. But he did it anyway, and...
Jim pulls his hands away, gritting his teeth. The pain in his voice hardens into helpless spite.
He went up against Kodos, and he got exactly what he deserved.
The world stops.
What? I said he deserved it, Jim says viciously. It was his own fault for running his stupid fat mouth.
He'd still be alive if he'd just shut up and taken what Kodos gave him like I did.
Winona slaps him hard. They stare at each other for a long, horrible moment. All she can see is the betrayal and bitter satisfaction in her George's eyes, in his face.
Maybe I should go.
George's face, George's eyes.
Jim says, very quietly.
Maybe you should, Winona replies, and finds that she's less tormented about it now that she said it out loud.
Jim isn't surprised either, and Winona doesn't know how to feel about that.
He just gives a tiny nod, a tight, bitter smile, and for another long moment they watch each other in the darkened living room, each caught in the mutual realization that they will not be seeing the other for a very long time. That they, perhaps, are seeing the other for the very last time.
At least the timing's convenient. You're going back to space, and I'm going to... somewhere.
Jim shrugs like it doesn't really matter, his voice too steady and too calm in the silence.
I'll just get my stuff together and go. You don't have to wait up for me if it hurts too much to watch him leave again.
He goes upstairs, and Winona moves like a ghost to her bedroom. Then she closes the door, sits on the edge of her bed, and waits. And waits. And waits. And listens to the muffled sounds of her son's footsteps downstairs. How Jim hesitates at the front door, waits for her. And waits. And then, finally, the slam of the door as both he and the ghost of his father leave her for what may be the final time. She can't breathe for the relief of it. The rush of adrenaline and the wind in his face as he sends his motorcycle into high gear never fails to calm him down. That is, until now. He's flying down the highway, probably pushing 120 at this point. He's not looking at the speedometer. He's not looking at the road. He stares into the golden red glare of the sunset, seeing nothing. Hearing nothing. Feeling nothing. Do it again. An inner voice urges him. Drive straight into that cliff. Do it again, but this time don't cop out at the last minute. Do it for real. Do what you were trying to do when you were 11 but didn't have the courage to finish. Do what you should have done when you were 11. It would have made everything a lot easier. He sees the cliff approaching, bends down over his motorcycle, urging it to go faster, take him faster, end it faster. He's almost there. Jim's breathing goes hard and erratic. All he has to do is not stop, and everything will be over. He doesn't have to be a burden on his mother, or a stain on the name of his father, or the failure to save his brother. He's almost there. He's almost... 10 yards from the cliff, Jim yanks the handlebars, swings out wide, and his wheels turn all at once, sending up a spray of dirt into the blinding sunset over the cliff, down into nothingness. He stares down at the drop, at his death, a mere half foot away, breathing hard and trembling all over. He's frozen there for what seems like hours, or maybe only seconds, following the drop with eyes and taking deep, shuddering breaths and feeling every bit like the stupid, weak, all too mortal kid he is. Jim feels something wet land on his right hand and is startled to see a teardrop. And then another. Another teardrop lands on the handlebar. Jim puts his hand to his face and realizes that he's crying. He's 6 inches from where he could have died. Probably should have died. And he's crying. And then he's curled into himself, clutching his stomach and sobbing like a child who can't help himself. Can only scream and cry and make a racket because he doesn't have any other way to say, "Help me, help me, help me." Waiting for someone to find him. And waiting. But of course, no one ever comes. Eventually the tears stop, and Jim wipes his face on a dirty sleeve. He needs to get away from this cliff. He needs to find somewhere he can stay tonight.
He needs... Jim has no idea what he needs, but he figures he can't go wrong with the usual. Getting laid, getting into a fight, and getting so drunk he can't see straight. Not necessarily in that order. And he knows just the place.
Nice try, the bouncer chuckles as Jim approaches. But absolutely not. You're just a kid.
Jim smirks and grabs the bouncer's tie, pulling him so close their noses almost brush. He licks his lips and watches the man's pupils dilate.
Wanna bet? He whispers.
Well, well. The Andorian chick he's been best buddies with for, 6 minutes or so, gives a filthy grin that goes straight to his groin. You can dance after all. He smirks, pulls her closer by the waist, replies,
I can do more than dance. I'm married, the bartender mutters as he pulls him into the storage room. So if anyone asks, I never said yes to this.
Jim straddles the man's hips and flashes him a wide, impish grin.
You don't have to say yes. You just have to not say no.
Jim wakes to an unfamiliar bedroom and a hideous hangover. He groans and rolls over, squinting against the pounding in his head. Jim's generous lodging donor for the night is turned away from him, but obviously female. He doesn't remember her name.
He doesn't remember her at all.
It's still dark outside, prime time for him to get lost before she wakes up. An unspoken infinity lies between sleeping with someone and sleeping with someone, and Jim has long understood the tightrope walk of needing the one while being terrified of the other. Jim closes his eyes, letting out a long, heavy breath. Then he swings his legs over the side of the bed, gets unsteadily to his feet, and gathers his clothing. It's all he has left, after all.